What is verse 2 of the Sit Darshana? But for those of you who have it, let's chant. Just repeat after me. So if you don't have the verse 1 on you, then just repeat after me. We'll always chant verse 1 and 2 because those are the two of the prayer verses. Yeah. So, considered by the commentators as prayer verses, introductory prayer verses. Om, Om, Sat Pratyakinu Vihaya Santam. Om, Sat Pratyakinu Vihaya Santam. Vridyesha Chintara Hito Vridakyaha. Vridyesha Chintara Hito Vridakyaha. Katam Smaramas Tamameyamekam. Katam smaramas tamameyamekam. Tasyas mitis tatra dhritaiva nishta. Tasyas mitis tatra dhritaiva nishta. Mityunjayam rityubhyashtatanam. Mityunjayam rityubhyashtatanam. Aham matir mrityumupaiti purvam. Aham mritir mrityumupayeti purvam. Atasvabhavad amriteshu teshu. Atasvabhavad amriteshu teshu. Katam punar mrityu dhiyo vakashaha. Katam punar mrityu dhiyo vakashaha. Mrityunjayam mrityu bhya Shritanam aham matihi mrityum upaiti purvam atha svabhavat amrateshu teshu katam punar mrityu dhiyaha avakashaha. It says, Mrityujayam. Mrityujayam means the one who has conquered death, the one who is free from death, the one who has conquered death. It's actually a name for Ishwar. In the Bhasha here it says, the Mrityujayam means Amarana Dharmanam Sarveshwaram. Sarveshwaram means Ishwar, the one who is the Lord of all, is the one whose dharma, whose nature is Amaranam, free of death. For Ishwara, for the Atma, for the Self, there is no change, so there is no birth, there is no death, there's just the constant presence of your being. And so for Ishwara, for Brahman, the Self, there is no death. And Ishwara is, Ishwara, the whole, thinking of the Lord as the one who is identified with the whole Maya Upadi, means the whole universe, if you think of it as an infinite mind. You know, like if I've used the example, if you were to imagine a meadow with animals and people and things in the meadow and clouds and trees, you know, and pathways and humans, the whole imagination is you. Right? It is yourself. Your being pervades the imagination. The imagination comes from you, sustained by you, is resolved into you. And so we would call that imagination as a manifestation of knowledge. Your meadow is going to be different than your meadow, than your meadow. So it's going to be coming from the unmanifest into the manifest. And that's what we call manifest knowledge. Like if I ask you to think of a pot, like a clay pot, or I ask you to think of a bird, every one of you will bring some form of a bird up into your mind that will come from your unmanifest knowledge into manifestation. And then that manifest knowledge will be, have its existence and being, the existence and being that it enjoys will be the conscious being which you are. Right? The bird of your imagination is something that comes and goes in your existence, into your being. It comes into your being, is sustained by your being, resolves into your being. But your being is not coming and going. Right? So say if I imagine a bird and I take myself to be the bird, then I, the bird, am subject to birth and death, right? Or say the bird in the imagination, the bird takes itself to be its being, its consciousness, to be, right? Its being and consciousness to be dependent on its name and form. In other words, when the bird is, the bird's being is, and the bird's consciousness is. That's from the standpoint of the bird. from the standpoint of the one from whom the bird has come into manifestation, where then there the bird is just, you know, manifest knowledge. For me, the one for whom the bird is manifest knowledge, I am free of the death of the birth and death of the bird. The bird's not free of its birth and death from its standpoint. Right? It has ignorance of its own truth. It has ignorance of its own truth. In fact, if I imagine the meadow and I have a bird flying through the meadow, you know, the bird is actually part and parcel of the whole meadow imagination. It's not even an entity, really. The entity is the conscious being that is the self of the whole imagination. But that entity, that conscious being, which is the I, the me, that the entire meadow enjoys from the standpoint of Ishwara, from the standpoint of myself as being the Lord of the meadow, right? From the standpoint of the bird, or the animals, or the grass, or the trees, or anything that has anyone that has a mind, any creature in the meadow, they're always going to say, I am the conscious being. This human form, me, this me here is the conscious being. And this body, mind, sense organs die. I die. That's because of self-ignorance, I've totally superimposed my being, you know, that which is free of death, onto that which is subject to continual change. If you superimpose your being, who you are, onto something that is bound by birth and death, then in your mind, you're bound by birth and death, right? Because you take yourself to be one with those things that are coming into being and going out of being. And that person who is subject to that ignorance is going to say, I am born and I die. But what about when you recognize that I'm not only, you know, that the conscious being that I enjoy as a jiva, as an individual, the conscious me that this body, mind, sense organs enjoys is not dependent on this body, mind, sense organs. When I recognize that, I'm rich in jam. I'm free of death. Because in reality, that is my nature. The nature of myself is something that doesn't come and go. And so for myself, if I use, this is all so obvious and easy to understand, in reference to myself as the Lord of the meadow imagination. Right? I'm its Lord. The meadow imagination, as complex as you want to make it. It comes from me. It enjoys myself. It is my manifest knowledge. I am the whole. From the standpoint of the meadow, I can easily say, I am the whole. Everything in the meadow, I am. Right? But I can as easily say, I am also free of the whole. I am the whole. I am the whole meadow. I am all beings in the meadow. I am all the laws of the meadow. And I am totally free of the meadow. Right? Because when the meadow goes, I still am. And now I can bring in, instead of a meadow, I can bring in like an ocean scene. Yeah. I can get rid of the ocean scene and I can bring in a Berkeley scene. Or I can bring in the scene of the whole universe. It doesn't make any difference. Whatever comes out of my knowledge, whatever comes as manifest knowledge, I am the self, the conscious being of that. But from the standpoint of that manifest knowledge, right, I can say I am the whole because it's not away from me. At the same time, I can say, I am free of the whole. And so here, when it says, now, in this verse, we're not dealing with the meadow imagination. That's easy for us to understand. We're dealing with ourselves as a jiva, as an individual, within this whole infinite creation. And so as an individual within this whole infinite creation, I have to get to a place, an understanding where I can say, you know, not that I am this body, mind, sense organs, which is subject to birth and death. I have to say that this I am this body, mind, sense organs, and I am free of this body, mind, sense organs. I have to be able to say both. But then if I can say that, I can say I'm this body, mind, sense organs, and I am free of it. Then I can go from there to saying, I am the whole, I'm the rug, I'm the table, you know, and I'm you, and I'm Ishwara, because the conscious being that I am is the one from whom all of this comes. So it's a big jump. It's easy for you as a limited individual, this body, mind, sense organs, to see the truth of your imaginations, of your creations, of your universes that you get to project on a subjective level, you know, that you can understand. There's no question about it. Even if we go from something like looking at our relationship to an imagination. No? We can also go just to our relationship with any thought, with any perception, with any emotion, with anything that comes to mind, with any experience that rises into consciousness, right? The experience rises into me, it is known by me, and it resolves into me. It's a good way when you just do like that meditation where you're just sitting quietly and letting your mind do whatever it is doing. It doesn't make any difference. Just whatever it is doing without any type of clinging, just totally welcoming it without any type of resistance, and just watching the thought flow, the emotions, the images come into being, go out of being, come into being, go out of being, come into being, go out of being. Being doesn't come into being and go out of being. Everything comes into being and goes out of being, but your being doesn't come into being and go out of being. So that's the viveka. That's the discrimination that you need to look into. You know, it's not just a theory. It's something to recognize. It's a reality to recognize that the conscious being, which really is what is labeled as me or I, the problem is that the first half of the label is correct. You say, I am, I exist, I am a conscious being, correct. The problem comes when you say, I am this conscious being that I am, is this body. I am this body. I am this mind. I am this body mind. See what I mean? The I am is perfect. So you have to be able to say that this body mind that I am, right? I am this body mind, and I am this soul, I am this jiva, I am this, and I am free from this. That part we don't know. Okay? This is me, and I am this, and I am also free from this. That way, it's a very important, which we call kind of satyam nitya, the clay pot phenomena, where the clay says correctly, absolutely correctly, when the clay says, I am the clay. The clay pot says, I am the clay. Right? That is a correct statement. You know? And when you say, I am a conscious being, that is a correct statement. So we all have it half right. It's all half right. Yeah. Because who you are, and even when you think of what we mean by Advaita, or non-dual, one without a second, you know, that has to be you. If there's only one thing, if it's one without a second, there's simply not two things. Right? That's what we mean by Advaita. There are not two things. There's only one being here. One existent being here. Only one. And so, if that's not you, you're not here. See what I mean? If it's not you, then you're not. Because there's only one chance. You either are or you aren't. And if you aren't, you're not here. But you are here. Right? You are here. Everything is here. And so everything, even if you can imagine the rug and the space and the chair and the table, to be able to say, I am, if it had a mind, it could say, I am. It would be totally correct. Right? Because it is. And I can go and say, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, everything that I experience, it is. And it is known. There's nothing away from that one being. You know? But the thing that is not recognized is that all of these things that are, it is, it is, it is, this body is, this mind is, this thought is, these sense organs are, there's a time when it is not. There's a time when it was not, a time when it will not be. And yet, the being which they all enjoy doesn't have that, isn't part of that same order of reality. It's not in the order of reality of coming and going. And so your task is to recognize your nature, the one that you are, that is actually present to all experience, which is your experience anyway. You know, you always say, you know, the one, I had this experience, then I had this experience, then I had this experience, then I had this experience. The I isn't going anywhere. Experiences are going, 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 going. So that's a viveka. That's a discrimination that you need to make. Once you make the discrimination, right, then you have recognized one who is free of the birth and death of all of the things that you experience. Anything within the manifest creation, within your manifest knowledge, anything that can be experienced by you, anything that comes and goes that exists within duality, right? All of those things are subject to birth and death. Mm-hmm. But that birth and death occurs in your presence. Right? Your being doesn't go through birth and death. Being itself doesn't go through birth and death. But the objects of perception, all that exists within manifest knowledge, does go through change. Change means birth and death. It's always change of the prior moment. Change of the prior moment is the death of the prior moment and the birth of the new moment. So everything in the universe is birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. But birth, death, birth, death, birth, death takes place in that one which is free of birth and death, which is being itself. And so here he says, Mrityunjayam, that one that is has conquered Mrityu. Mrityu means death. Since it's a word for Ishwar, the Lord, because for the Lord there is no birth and death. There's birth and death of all manifest experience and manifest knowledge, but not of me. You know, the one who is the truth, the self of all of this manifest knowledge. For Ishwar is infinite manifest knowledge. Right? So Mrityunjayam, Mrityunjayam. So Mrityubhya. Due to the fear of death. Bhya means fear. Mrityu means death. So Mrityunjayam for Sanskrit people, Mrityunjayam is in the accusative. Mrityubhya is a compound in the instrumental. Then Shritanam. So now this says, for those who seek refuge in the Lord, Shritanam, for those bhaktas, for those devotees, for those mumukshus, those who desire liberation, genitive plural, for those who seek refuge in Ishwara, in the one who has conquered death, who is free of death, why do they seek refuge in Ishwara? Because they themselves are afraid of death. In fact, all sukha dukkha, pleasure pain, can be contained in this fear of death. Right? So it's fear of loss, it's fear of loss of myself, fear of loss of ananda, fear of loss of wholeness, fear of loss of well-being. That's what everybody fears, you know. And fear of the inability to gain it, so it's all fear, 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 fear. And fear, the fear of loss of my being. So for those who seek refuge in the one who is free of death, is Ishwar and the Lord, because of their own fear of death, then it says, aham matihi mrityum upaiti purvam, the purvam, the first thing to go for those who seek refuge in the Lord. The first thing to go is the ahamkara, the aham matihi, the I thought. That is mrityum upaiti. That's the first one to line up and die. Upaiti means that's the first one. That's the first one that's going to approach death. That's going to go to death. Is what? The ahamkara. So what is the ahamkara? The ahamkara. Ahamkara means I notion. Your sense of I. The ahamkara.
It's too hot.
Are they gone?
My computer's like a blank. I know, but they're all here too. They're sitting there waiting to see what's going to happen. So nothing's going to happen. Oh, there they are.
There's a bunch of them.
You can hear, okay. You're right, I was worried about you. This computer is not doing well. It needs to go to the hospital. Okay, good. Okay.
It needs a warning up for Steve Jobs.
Yeah. You know, I just read an article But Steve said his last words. You know what his last words were? Wow. 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 Those were his last words. His sister wrote about it. I'm a fan of his. I think he's an amazing person. Okay. And she mentioned it. Okay. Aham Matihidi, Ahamkara. So let's look at the Ahamkara. What makes you what we call a jiva, an individual? An individual jiva means I am this person, this body, mind, sense organs, this soul, this transmigrating entity. I am this one, and you are that one, and you are that one, and you are that one. So the Ahamkara is really, if I were to break it, the Ahamkara is making of an I. I create an I. I give myself to this body, you know. Aham Matihi means the conviction of I. It means the Aham Mati. The notion, the conviction of the I belonging to this body, mind, sense, organ. So, for instance, if I say, I am going to the store, right? What I mean by that I is this body, mind complex, me, is going to the store. I am walking, you know? If I say, I am reading a book, then I am, you know, this person who is sitting here using my mind and my sense organs to read the book. That's what I mean by the word I. And so if to me the word I doesn't go any farther than the upadhi, the conditioning adjuncts, like for instance, an upadhi means, the upadhi is an important word in Vedanta. It means anything that can lend itself to a point of identification. So this body, for instance, this is an upadhi. It's a conditioning adjunct because I can say with all seriousness and conviction that I am this body. Or I can say I am a woman, I am tall or thin or fat, I am pretty or ugly or whatever the adjectives that can be put onto the physical body, I am well or I am sick. Right? These are all taking the I to belong to be one with this object. That's what an upadhi is called. So the physical body lends itself, either itself as a whole or whatever its qualities are, will lend itself to that identification. It'll take on me. Another upadhi are my sense organs. I can say, you know, I have eyes, I see, I hear, I taste, I touch. That means I identify with the sense organs as being belonging to me. Same with my thoughts. I can say, I am my mind. Or I could say, you know, I am smart or stupid or dull, or I am happy or agitated or sad. Whatever quality, I can take myself to be the whole mind, or whatever the qualities of the mind are. So that becomes a conditioning adjunct. So anytime I take myself to be the upadhi, whatever it may be, you know, even it can be even in relationship, but like if I were to say, I am a mother, a daughter, a sister, a teacher, a student, you know, or an employer, an employee, or a child to my parent, whatever it may be, I'm identifying myself with the upadhi, with the body that has that particular relationship with that person. So whenever there is that identification, the ahankara is alive. It's doing well, right? It's alive and well. Okay. Now, for a jnani, for somebody who has self-knowledge, you still can say, I'm going to the store, or I'm the sister, mother, or daughter, whatever. You'll still say those things. But there's another reality, which you'll talk about when you're teaching a class. Otherwise, you're not going to walk around and say, I'm going to the store, but you know, I'm really not going to the store. It's my body that's going to. I won't bother to say that. But you know that. You know it. You know who you are. But for somebody who doesn't have self-knowledge, they are, in their mind, when the ahankara the I notion is their point of identity. So if I say I am this body, or I believe I'm I take myself to be a transmigrating soul, or I believe in life after death, I believe in reincarnation, then I'm taking myself to be a jiva that transmigrates, takes life after life after life. Or if I say I'm a soul, I believe that on the death of this body, I go to heaven, or I go to hell, or I go to purgatory. Or I could say I go to, if I'm a Hindu, I'll say I'll go to different planes of existence, you know, and then live out my punya or papa there and then come back, transmigrating. But then I'm taking myself again still to be a jiva, because I am going upon death to this loka, to this plane of existence and coming back, and you're going to this one and coming back. And then I could even say to you, gee, maybe if we die at the same time, we'll go to the same loka. We'll go to the same level and meet each other there. Or maybe when you and I come back and take a birth here, I'm sure we'll hook up in one form or another. We'll meet each other in one form or another. We can talk like that, because and from a Hindu perspective, that's also true. We don't have any problem with that. But it's true on this relative level, where you're taking yourself to be an individual different from the whole. You're taking yourself to be confined to only be a part to the whole. See what I mean? So whether you take yourself to be a transmigrating soul or this body, mind, sense organs, you're still only a part within the whole and different from other parts. So when that's the case, there's the ahankara. So here Ramana is saying, it's that ahankara that is the first to die. For those who seek Ishwara, seek the Lord, want to gain knowledge. They want to gain knowledge from the Lord, because the Lord is free from death. The first thing that's going to go for them is the ahankara, this I notion, this sense of identification with those things, those upadhis, which are actually limiting adjuncts that belong to the whole. Right? Just think of it. If you have the meadow imagination and you're walking in your imagination with just you there and your friends, and you're walking on a pathway across the meadow, you know, everything in that meadow, including your body, mind, sense organs, belongs to the meadow. It's not like you imagine the meadow and put all of the people in it, including yourself, and that your body, mind, sense organs has some special relationship with you that is other than the relationship that the entire meadow has with you. In fact, you're the self of everything in the meadow. Your being, your me, when you say me or I am, that amness, the being that you are, you know, is the being, is the I of the whole meadow. So you can say it is the eye of the whole meadow, and from the standpoint of the meadow, everything in the meadow will say, I am, I am, I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being. All the beings that have a mind or a subtle body are going to say that. I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being, I am the conscious being. And the Lord of the meadow, the whole meadow itself, will say, I am the conscious being. Okay? And it will say, that's Ishwara, I am the conscious being, and I am free of the meadow also. I am the conscious being of the meadow, and I am free of the meadow also. That is the truth. And so for you, the one who wants to escape fear of death, what does that mean? How is it even possible? It isn't possible. It's not in the cards for something that exists within duality and by its very nature is subject to birth and death to say, I'm going to be free of birth and death. It's just a fantasy. This body's not going to be free of birth and death. The sense organs won't be free of birth and death. The mind won't be free of birth and death. Anything that's bound by change is not free of birth and death. Right? There's always change of the first one moment into the birth of the next moment. And so that's what's going to happen. Is there something, though, in your self-experience, like say, for instance, just this jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, me, that is free of birth and death? If there is such a thing, it's not going to be an object in the world, because there's no thing in the world within duality that can be objectified. It's free of birth and death. And so if you are free of birth and death, right, that means you already are free. Right? If you are free of birth and death, if there is such a thing about you, then that's a given fact. Do you see why that would be? If in reality you are free of birth and death, then whatever that is, being free of birth and death is already here, free of birth and death. Does it sound silly? But it's absolutely, there's no other way it can be. Right? If your body's not free of birth and death, your mind isn't free of birth and death, your sense organs aren't free of birth and death, even the ahankara, the I thought that comes and goes, just a vritti, it's just a thought, that's not free of birth and death. Your various knowledges and experiences, none of them are free of birth and death. Right? Anything that exists within duality, within the whole manifest knowledge, is not free of birth and death. Right? And so, what is that? Another way of saying it. So if you are your body, if that's who you are, you're not free of birth and death. If you're the transmigrating jiva, you're not free of birth and death, because you're always changing. You're free of birth and death in the sense that the transmigration goes on and on and on. But the change of all of those components are bound by change. There's nothing in it that's not free of change, so not free of birth and death. Sense organ same, you know, a whole complex, jiva complex same. And so, is there anything, can you wait?
Yeah.
Is there anything left in your experience that is free of birth and death? And if there is something left that's free of birth and death, it's already here. Because it's free of birth and death. It's not coming and going. See what I mean? And so now this becomes something to recognize. And that recognition is what we call viveka. And even in all, for some students who have studied the Shuddarshanas, you know, the different schools of thought like Sankhya Yoga, Buddhism, the Vaisheshikas, all of the different darshanas and that they talked about in India, this viveka jnana, it's called viveka jnana, discriminative knowledge, is that very term itself is used in all of these darshanas, because moksha or liberation, if there is such a thing as moksha or liberation, it has to already be here. It's not something that can be created. It has to be a reality. Because if something is free from birth and death, it either is you or it's not you. If it's not you, it's irrelevant. But it either is you or is not you. If it's not you, then there's no moksha for you. You're subject to birth and death for change. If it is you, then what's wrong with you then? What are you talking about? It is you. What's your problem? Right? Your problem. The problem is ajnana, is ignorance, self-ignorance. True for all the darshanas. They have different things that they say about that. They have different ways of dealing with knowledge, what they think knowledge is. They even have different ideas about the nature of reality. But this one thing they share, that it is about knowledge. Because if you are not already free, if your nature is not already free, you can't become free. Because that means that you've bound, your nature is bound. Like trying to make this body become free. Mm. We do our best, you know, yoga and tai chi and eating well and getting enough sleep and all these different things that we do to try to give a kind of a relative well-being as long as the body lasts. But nobody's going to say, I'm going to do yoga and eat a macrobiotic diet or an Ayurvedic diet so that I can be free of death. Nobody's going to say it. But they'll say, I do those things so that as long as I'm alive, I will have a good instrument. And that's the same, very same thing and practical thing to say. Even in terms of the way that we are with our mind, the way that the different ways we learn how to handle the mind, your mind and your moods and your emotions and all of these things, a certain skill in ways of relating to the world and all these things to give us relative well-being in a world that is fraught with difficulty. But as we mature and we learn Dharma and things like that, we learn how to be in the world in a way that can give relative shanti, relative peace. But still, we're trip up and fall all of the time, really, tripping up and falling in this way or that way, or this thing is too difficult to handle. The mind has constant challenges that are coming its way. Is there something that is not subject to tripping and falling, or to having to maintain its equipoise? See the problem? If I have to maintain my equipoise, birth and death. And so then I have to very skillfully maintain my equipoise. Why? Birth and death. See what I mean? I have to skillfully maintain the health in my body. Why? Birth and death, that's its nature. Is there something that I don't have to maintain? Is there something which is free of birth and death? My being, which simply is free by its very nature. So here, if that's not there, there's no freedom. If it is there, and you still feel bound, what is the problem? Is simply lack of viveka jnana, means that discriminative knowledge where I recognize the one who is constant and solid, constant, stable, and is always there really as the innermost presence or very self, the very being of my mind, body, sense organs, and all of my experience. So here he says, here in the whole teaching methodology, even, he says so beautifully, for the one who seeks this knowledge, who really surrenders to Bhagavan, his way of saying for that mumukshu, he realizes I don't have the answer, there's not a solution here. And it surrenders because of recognizing the pervasiveness of the problem which I cannot escape. That's the mrityunvya. Then the first thing to go is this ahankara, which is the false notion, the false identification of my own self with all of these experiences that do come and go. So it's the release of that I notion, that ahankara. And then he says, atta, and then swabhavat amriteshu teshu, and then among those people who, those means us, you know, who do have self-knowledge, who have recognized themselves as amrita, free of death, for talking from the standpoint of a jiva, otherwise there's only one atma, but here it says from all those who are amrita, who are free of death, means for those who have recognized the nature of the self as free of death, as how are they free of death? You know, not because they're warding off death, but because they're very swabhava. Swabhava, fifth case, from their very swabhava, from their very nature. They are amrita, free of death, by your very nature. So among those people who have recognized, for whom the ahankara has bitten the dust, you know, has gone to death, you know. So once that ahankara has gone, has bitten the dust, has gone to death, then among those people, you know, who have recognized themselves as free of death because of their very being, their very nature, like the self from whom the meadow has come, I'm the self from whom the whole creation has come, then he says, katam punar mrityudhyaha avakasha. He says, then how again, katam punaha, katam means how, puna, how again, he says, avakashaha mrityudhyaha, how again is there any space, any room for this mrityudhyaha, for this idea, for this concept of death? How for such a person who has recognized their own nature as being timeless, as being free from death, how for them is there any space left for the concept of death? How can you say, once you've recognized yourself, how can you say, I am going to die, when your being itself is free of any type of change? That recognition is here and now. It's because your being, once you recognize as we do this, all of these different teachings, Ramana is just going to go through verse by verse, he's just a prayer verse, right? So it's very encapsulating. As we go through recognizing, differentiating my own self from every aspect of my experience, the experience of the creation, the experience of Ishwara, the experience of the body, the sense organs, every experience that I have, the experience of my waking state, my dream state, my deep sleep state, once I'm ever to I'm able to differentiate myself, my being, which can't be objectified to be a participant in this change, this world of change. Once I've differentiated my being, and it is my being, it's not some concept of my being, it is the very me that I take myself to be now, the person who says, remember when I said the person who says I am the body? That person is half right. The I am that they're referring to as the body is the I am that they are. But what about when you realize that this I am, the me, not the words, but the me that the I am refers to, that this me, you know, is free of time, is free of change, is timeless, is not subject at all to birth and death. You've recognized that as your own being as you watch all experience come and go, come and go, and come and go without it touching you in any way. So once you recognize that, you become free of death. Not the body, not the mind, not the sense organs, not the changing universe, you know, but the self of the changing universe. That me is free of death. Where is there room for any other concept? Where is there room for me now to come back and say, I'm subject to death? To come back and say, I'm subject to death. Once that viveka is there, once you've differentiated your own presence from the things that change, then how can I come back and say, I am those things that I'm looking at, that I'm watching change? I am that. How can you do it once you've differentiated? Because your own experience is that you remain the same as these things change that you experience. You can't bring back the ajnana. Once ignorance is removed, you can't get it back. It's like we use the example. If I'm walking along a path at dusk and I imagine a rope as a snake, I can react with fear. I have all of the responses toward that snake because I saw the snake. And I saw I didn't see the rope. I saw the snake. But if my friend says, no, hey, come back here and take a look. That wasn't a snake. I promise you. It was only a rope. Please come back and look. You come back and see the rope. Same three bends. Sees where the fangs was, a little piece of rope sticking out of the edge. Right? You see, it wasn't a snake, it's only a rope. Now you see the rope. Now try to get that snake back. Go hard, look this way, that way. You can't get it back. Because you've seen the rope. You've recognized the rope. It is the same here. Once I recognize myself, my being, as the changeless presence, the very sat-chit, the very existence, the consciousness that is the being, the self of every experience I have, once I recognize its stability, that it's self-shining, that it's not objectifiable as an object in the world that can come and go once I see it, how can I not see it then? You know? Even, I'll tell you, once you get it, even when your mind continues acting ignorantly, you know, like instead of recognizing myself as the wholeness which I seek, the mind habitually goes out and wants this and that and the other thing and gets itself in a tizzy. It's doing all of that in the presence of yourself, in the presence of yourself, which isn't doing anything. And so even the process of the mind's maturing is taking place in a free self. Once that free self has been recognized, you can't not recognize it once it's known, even if your mind habitually behaves ignorantly. That ignorant behavior, that emotional upset is taking place in a free self. They'd rather not have the emotional upset. They'd rather not have, you know, the qualities that are produce pain. That has to, that, those things mature in time. But all of those upsets and things that drop off in time are presenting themselves there and dropping off in time within my presence, which is ever free. So that's why he says, how again, where's there any room? Once you've recognized, how's there any room for this? And even if your mind's behaving foolishly, you can say, my mind's just behaving foolishly because it's done so from beginningless lifetimes. It's just taking me a while for some of these things to drop off. Okay. Okay, let's stop there. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
You said the first two verses are prayer verses?
Most of the Prakarna Granthas means the explanatory texts of the Vedanta Upanishads. There's a lot of them. This Satdarshan is one. Usually the first or second verse is something, a verse that's considered all-encompassing in some way, a prayer verse evoking the Lord in some way. In some way it'll also just give a vision of the knowledge. And so here it's both, they're evoking the Lord, evoking Nishta. So the commentators will say, this commentator looks at these first two verses as prayer verses, which is common, first or second verse.
So it's a prayer to
Ishwara, to this Ishwara, to Atma, to the Brahmajnanam.
Yeah, I was wondering, because there's a rather famous prayer, and I believe it's the Lord Shiva, called the Mrityunjaya Mantra.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Mrityunjaya Mantra. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you should be looking at Shiva also as Ishwara, right? Brahma is Ishwara, Vishnu is Ishwara, Shiva is Ishwara, not as an individual deity within the creation. It's a manifestation of Ishwara. Mm-hmm. So we call Ishwara Brahmaji or Brahma, not Brahman, Brahma is in the masculine, as Ishwara manifesting the whole creation, as Vishnu in the creation, sustaining the creation, as Shiva in the resolution of the creation.
And one of the names for Lord Shiva is even Maheshwara.
Maheshwara, Rudra,
yeah.
Shiva. All of the different deities have many different names. Like there's a text we're going to do at one of these classes sometime. This is 1001 names of Shiva, not the Vishnu, the Vishnu Sahasranam, 1000 names of Vishnu. Swamiji wrote this really beautiful commentary on.
Wow, that's a lot of names to remember.
Each name is a vision. It's amazing. If you go through that whole thing, it'll finish you off. That's what Swamiji actually said in his Gita Home Study, and from in his perspective, the Gita Home Study and the Vishnu Sahasranama, you know, have contained everything that he has to say, really. And all, I mean, I can't praise the Gita Home Study highly enough, because all of the different, whatever is of real value in all of the different commentaries, of course, most of what's in Shankara's commentary, there's other commentators also that have had important things to say. Swamiji unfolds the verse of the Gita, and then he unfolds it, and what Shankara and other commentators are saying, he also unfolds that. Where you read it in Sanskrit, there's just one sentence. But with Swamiji, he takes that sentence and he makes you really understand what it means. Mm-hmm. And so to study, and the Gita has everything. everything, including so much of the antakarana shuddhi, gaining, you know, a mind, how to be in the world with this knowledge in a way that helps you to own it up. That's all yoga. That's all they call karma yoga, is in the Gita, along with the entire vision of the Upanishads. It's even praised as another Upanishad. It's like the, if you look at the Upanishad as the cow, then Krishna is milking it and milking the cow, and the milk is the Bhagavad Gita, which is fed to the calves. We're the calves. Fed this assimilated knowledge that's there in the Gita. The Gita, Bhagavad Gita, is a really amazing book. It needs a good commentary, though, it can be misunderstood.
Well, in a way, it's very outstanding for the tradition as well. I mean, it stands.
It's a centerpiece.
Pardon me?
It's a centerpiece, even the, for the tradition. Even the Mahabharata, which is a main, huge epic, 18-volume epic, the whole story of the Pandavas, and never mind about that, but anyway, it's located, the Gita is right in the middle of it, of the, this 18-volume thing, right in the middle is the Bhagavad Gita. It's amazing. And if you read in some of these, like the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, you should never read a condensed version. You can if you just, you know, it's like, what? If you read a condensed version, it's like watching TV or something where they take all of the meaningful things out of it and just leave the action story. They leave, you take all of the stuff out.
Yeah, all the wars.
But if you read the Mahabharata in its unabridged form, it has so much Vedanta in it, you know. So much Vedanta, so much wisdom, so much worldly wisdom, so many examples of how to handle yourself in difficult situations. You know, like when in Jung, if you have studied Jung at all, he always will use amplification, like when he's working with a client, he'll use what we call amplification, and that means that, first of all, you know, one thing that happens in therapy is the client, he calls it, it's going to confession, where you say everything that's bothering you, and even the things that you would never tell another person. And then working through that, but there's, as you go on, there's something called amplification, where you bring in a myth, because all the myths, and we put them at Ramayana and Mahabharata, all of these things in that category, these myths are things that have stood the test of time. They're archetypal. You know, they've lasted for centuries. And in all of these myths are stories. There's so many stories of how a person handled a given situation. Right? And so it's very gratifying in a way, or very helpful to the psyche when you're in a difficult situation, you know, that's causing you a lot of stress and pain and worry, a lot of loss or whatever it is that is stressful. And your therapist, somebody like you, who has the whole gamut, or you can say, this is very much like what Rama went through when he lost Sita, what Sita went through when she was with Ramana. Just you think, you have hundreds of them in your mind, you know, these archetypal stories. And then you can tell that story and the person feels themselves being held by a greater context. You know, it's very, and so what I'm saying that is when, I remember when I was younger in India and I read the whole Mahabharata, I must have been 22 or 23, read the whole Mahabharata and Ramayana, and I was so, it was huge for me, because for me the way that a human being is portrayed and how they handle them in situations, you know, was so, what word can I say? It matched reality for me, you know. and where I had felt like what I had come with didn't match reality. Just like, for instance, to see situation after situation where all of these exalted figures, whether it be Sita or Rama or Arjuna, or, you know, all, and the exalted figures, you know, are men and women, not just men. And so you get to see the whole gamut of emotion that human beings, even the gods and goddesses, have the whole gamut of emotion. And the thing is how do they handle it? How do they handle these very difficult situations, and how do they handle their emotions? And so it was revelatory for me to see that all of the archetypes have emotions, the whole gamut of emotions, and the Dharma or the freedom comes more in how you are with those emotions. And not freedom, that's a different level, but your Dharma, you know, how you are, how you handle the situation. And just have examples, so many, you know, thousands of examples.
Conflict resolution.
How these conflictual situations are handled and what the different people go through. Because in these ethics, they talk about everything that's going on internally and externally. All of the feelings, they don't shove anything under the rug.
How to resolve.
Yeah, how in that particular situation it's resolved.
And that differs from getting rid of those events or
you know, they don't pretend like they're not there. It's not like the world all of a sudden becomes really nice, you know, nice and clever and easy. It's that the difficult situations are there. And even they look at, like if they look at the life of Krishna, for instance, or the life of Rama, it's filled with difficulties, you know. How are those difficulties handled?
Recently I was reading the Ramayana, and I want to go back because, like you said, I ended up by getting a translation by an American, which is, like, I can see why they, you know, it's somewhat colorful. It's the Buck translation. So it was a Californian that translated it.
That's very much edited version.
It's an abridged version. The plot line.
Because it's abridged. I mean, the plot line in the Mahabharata is, I mean, there's so, at first in the first several volumes, there's so many stories.
Yeah.
You know, that even go way beyond the Pandavas and
hundreds of stories. I'm reading this, you know, and what I want to do is go and find the real, the Ramacharitamanas. That's what I was told, what I should really get from Gita Press.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So I want to go get that. But meanwhile, I started reading it, and there's that one, there's a tale in it where they're having a trouble with Ravana's brother.
Yeah.
And so Brahma can't, you know, goes and asks his wife, Saraswati is his wife, and says, how can we deal with Kumbhakarna?
Yeah.
And so Saraswati is about having, you know, speech and the skill of using speech. And she has, someone mispronounce a word. I can't how it, but it, instead of saying it correctly, they say the mantra incorrectly, and he ends up putting Kumbhakarna to sleep. So that was the clever way.
Oh, I see.
That they handle this Rakshasa, you know, this Kumbhakarna, the brother of Ravana.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that reminds me, you know, in Sanskrit chanting, like when we're using particular swaras, they use exact stories, not this story, but other stories like this. You have to have the swaras correct, say them correctly. Because if you don't say them correctly, it can mean something else. Mm-hmm. So you're actually chanting something else. You have to be really fastidious.
Well, can't you ask for forgiveness first before you... I mean,
you should. You should always say... You say, Bhagavan, please accept this as though it's properly chanted. You have to do that before you chant.
Because I don't want the wrong results. I mean,
if it's... That's only if they're in Vedic and there's swaras there, you know. You know, and you say you're doing a mala or something, you're doing repetition. You should try to do your best to get the proper pronunciation and then make, it's called a sankalpa. It's very common, in fact. Often even pujaris will make that sankalpa, that resolve. You know, in Sanskrit they'll say, please accept this as being done properly. Being done properly and with shraddha. Shraddha means, you know, with proper devotion and faith. Please accept this as being done with that. But Bhagavan can be your editor. Or she didn't mean to say Indra. She meant to say Indra.
then you're in hot water.
The stories make it so memorable. Whether you understand the story or not, the plot line that carries the message is so memorable. There's, yeah. You know, it's colorful.
I'm pointing out the Hindu, but we have it in all the traditions. And we're not maybe as, these stories are not as predominant now, a lot of ancient stories, but like say if you were to read the Odyssey or, you know, the season, the Iliad, and different epics that we have available, and you go back in time, you'll also feel, you'll realize kind of a wholeness in the person. They're not trying to, but they don't try to hide their emotions, whether they're men or women. And they're put in situation after situation after situation. So Jung's more interested. He doesn't know that much about India. But he uses all this amplification just with the Western myths that are there available to us.
Hmm. My mother read them to me when
you were little.
And I'm so shocked by how selfish and greedy and how violent they were.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, because that value of ahimsa is the primary value. Yeah. And then they're having all these battles, and guys are getting stabbed, and somebody's stealing somebody's house.
Even 5,000 years ago. That's not very promising, isn't it? We have to deal with our human nature. Yeah. Yeah, it's all there, repeating itself over and over. In all of the epics, too, there's always this battle between the dark and the light. You know, between the good and the bad. There's always, on every level, there's these battles taking place.
The 1% against the 99%.
The Rakshasas, you know, against the Devas.
You know, with this Ramana, I'm getting the sense that he has a very deep cultural background. It doesn't sound like just somebody making a self-discovery independent of a context.
No, I mean, he's also within the tradition, for sure.
Yeah.
No, he's a... Yeah.
Isn't he from a Brahmin?
I'm not sure, but I know that he's accepted as an invitee, you know, highly respected, and he's an Indian. If you watch, I have some films on him, you know, one long hour, I think it's more of an hour film, it's actual footage of him and his life, and he's definitely an Indian. Yeah, it's a beautiful film, actually. Let's call it a night, please. I'm going to get up really early in the morning for